This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Showing us the way today is Jamie Dimon jumping on board the get jabbed or lose your job, basically.
Yeah, that's actually happening. And I think we're going to see that happen more and more with other companies. We're also hearing from Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez saying that Europe should consider the possibility of treating COVID-19 as an endemic illness. That's familiar, given that we've heard similar things from lawmakers across the world.
And I feel like you always bring that up with anybody we talk to in the healthcare community. You're always like, is this, we have to start thinking more from, go from pandemic to endemic.
Well, let's get into it with Brian Granulati, Chief Executive Officer at Atlantic Health System. Atlantic Health System serving nearly 5 million people throughout 11 New Jersey counties, 7 hospitals, 17,000 team members, nearly 5,000 physicians. Brian, it's great to have you back with us. How are you?
Great. Thank you. Great to talk to you guys again.
Hey, Brian, where I want to start with you is just an update from the hospitals and what you're seeing there. Just give us the numbers and how full they are, how under stress they are.
Sure. So in our hospitals today, we have a little over 500 patients. And at a program we have at Hospital at Home, another 100. Now, to give you some comparison, that compares to about 900 and 200 when we were at the beginning of the pandemic. So we're about half of where we were.
Despite the fact that cases have spiked dramatically, who are the people who are being hospitalized with COVID right now?
Quite frankly, the bulk of the people that are getting hospitalized have not been either completely vaccinated or boosted. And let me give you a number to think about. 14 of the patients that we have in our hospitals today, and I told you that the aggregate number, have had a COVID and a booster. What that tells me is get your vaccines, get your booster, and there's a very slight probability you're going to end up in a hospital.
So 14 of the hundreds of patients you have who are hospitalized with
those
COVID.
Those breakthroughs, right? Is that what that is?
Yeah. And that's a very low number. So, you know, my plea to anybody that listens is this thing is real. Get your COVID booster, and that's going to relieve the pressure we have in our hospitals.
The numbers, do you feel like they're peaking?
Yes. You know, the last week or so, we've been flat at around this 500 number, and our modeling really shows us that we're going to go down in the next week or two. And if it follows the pattern that has occurred in other countries, you're going to see a precipitous drop. And, you know, every morning when I get up and look at our data, I pray that that's starting.
How are emergency rooms doing? Like, if you go to an emergency room in the Atlantic Health System, are you seen quickly?
Emergency rooms are very stressed, not just at Atlantic, but in every area where we have this high COVID level of activity. And one of the reasons is people are using it as a testing center. And that was very apparent 2 weeks ago, because you got to remember, we're in week four right now of this, what I call fifth surge. And so what we've had to do in order to decant those emergency departments is put testing sites outside the emergency departments and also create them throughout our communities. And we now have over 15 centers. So our EDs are still very busy, but not as crazy as it was 2 weeks ago.
So, you know, Brian, you know, shocking, we all think about it, like here we are in our third year of this, and we're talking about pandemic to endemic, and maybe that is a way to manage it more. But how do you see it? Like, what are your thoughts? You've got a plan, you've got a massive system, you've got a team. What are your biggest struggles right now? We talk a lot about the shortage of healthcare workers. What are your biggest concerns for this year? What are your biggest hopes?
So my biggest concern and my biggest hope is that people get vaccinated and they get boosted. If we do those simple things, it's going to affect all aspects of this, getting people back into restaurants, getting people back into their offices, as well as decanting the healthcare system. But, you know, and we've got the tools now. If you think about this back, you know, when this pandemic started, the glimmer of a vaccine and the glimmer of having antivirals was almost impossible to imagine. And we have that today. So we just got to get people to use the technology we have and the innovation that we have And, you know, this thing will become endemic, and we can treat it like a flu.
Would you say that any of your hospitals are overwhelmed right now?
You know, our hospitals are very, very busy, and our teams have been doing an incredible job, because you've got to couple this with the fact that, you know, team members are getting sick also because this is endemic. I'll throw another quick number out at you. We run testing for both asymptomatic, meaning people who have no symptoms, might want to go somewhere, and symptomatic patients. The spread on that is only 5% in terms of positivity. If you're symptomatic and you get tested, it's about 35%. If you're asymptomatic, it's about 30%. So this virus is in the community. Look to your left, look to your right. You're going to see somebody that's had COVID or has COVID. And because of that, I think, that is a huge, huge drag on everything.
Brian, quickly, 20 seconds. Have you had COVID?
I have not had COVID.
Okay. Well, let's hopefully keep it that way. Tim and I, same thing. Fingers crossed.
I mean, I could have had it at the beginning. I would have no idea.
That's the same. I know. That's how I feel. Brian, you always give us great insight. Thank you so much. Be well. Stay safe. Brian Granulati, he is Chief Executive Officer at Atlantic Health System, a massive system in New Jersey, on the phone from Morristown, New Jersey.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Listen, I am obsessed with this story. Doug's going to listen to it. You all should listen to it. It's about the elite U.S. educational institutions. You know, Yale, MIT, Columbia, a lot of others, Duke, many more, too, that are being sued for colluding to limit students' financial aid packages. Tim, I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah, Janet Lauren is joining us now. She's higher education reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from New York City. Janet, fair to say both of us are obsessed with this story. We got to start at the beginning here. What are these elite colleges being accused of? I mean, we should note there are some names that are not on here as well. Harvard, for example, is not on here.
Well, I think you really have to go back to the early 1990s when they really were truly colluding. The Department of Justice had a pretty landmark case against most of these schools, the Ivies and MIT and others. And they really literally were sitting in a room together and saying, student X is going to get this amount of financial aid, student Y is going to get this. And that practice, there was a big settlement that you saw in the lawsuit, the term 568, and that was a section of the code that referred to the agreement of these schools. And I think after that, the schools have been pretty careful not to do anything that looks like they're colluding. You know, these are among the most sophisticated operations on earth. And I don't think they're going to jeopardize anything by colluding. However, what this lawsuit says, if I could kind of understand what they're saying, is that perhaps there's other ways where, there may be issues such as if kids get off wait lists, are they, need blind in admissions? Are they giving the benefit to wealthier applicants because perhaps they don't need financial aid? So the lawsuit wasn't entirely clear to me. However, there are some big names. One of the attorneys involved was a prosecutor in the Varsity Blues case. There's a lot of big names in there. And I guess we should explain what need blind admissions is also.
Talk to us, because Janet, I feel like, right, that's been a great thing that the schools have put out there. Like, apply, we don't care whether you need aid or not, just apply and we're going to look at all of you equally the same. But what does it mean, really?
So what that means is if you are asking for financial aid, these colleges ask you a lot of questions because they don't want to be giving money to families who can legitimately afford it. So they ask you a lot of questions about your income, your savings, your investments. They're not supposed to look at your retirement, but I believe they do ask about that. And some schools count home equity and some schools don't. So you wanted to know why some schools were not on that list. For example, Harvard, I believe, does not count home equity in your formula. So that makes it more generous. So the question is, how does this all work? Is it really true that the colleges don't look at your finances? And they admit you, and then they look at how much money they're going to give you. And it's a pretty expensive proposition for these schools. You know, you're talking about financial aid budgets in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So I think what the lawsuit was saying is, wealthier kids have more of an advantage, which in some ways we kind of already know that. They do take legacies if your parents went there.
But where does the colluding with other schools come into this? Like, where is there is there alleged to be communication between these schools, between these elite universities and colleges that actually name students?
So these schools do get together as a group and come up with a formula of how they award aid. Now, not everybody is using the same formulas. For example, Yale may be a lot more generous in their financial aid. But it's, you know, adhering to at least a standard formula. And there's a bunch of formulas out there that institutional methodology, you know, the private schools tend to be a lot more generous because they have more money.
So, Jenny,
looking at these formulas.
Let me jump in just because we've got about a minute or so left here. But I do wonder, you know, I think students have been instructed that, you know, you can apply for financial aid. It's not going to be held against you. But is it ultimately that we might find out that that is held against you?
I don't think so. I think that the colluding is looking at the formulas, and our wealthier kids deemed, you know, if they get off the wait list, are they going to be full payers? But again, the argument is not entirely clear to me.
Hmm. What are the colleges and universities saying that have been accused here?
They're not commenting. You know, like corporations, they typically don't comment on, you know, pending lawsuits. But Yale did say, you know, their financial aid policies are 100% in line and legal.
So we apologize, Janet. You've got another story, and we're going to have to tell everybody to check it out online, and we'll put it out on Twitter about school slashing athletic programs amid financial strain and students successfully campaigning to revive them by leaning on Title IX, the 50-year-old law. It's another great read and great reporting, and good to just check in with you, Janet. Janet Loren is our higher education finance reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone in New York City. You can find her on Twitter at Janet Loren. Also, just go to Bloomberg.com, check out her stories.
So interesting that she said that one of the prosecutors is one of the ones in the Varsity Blue scandal, because when you and I read this yesterday, it was the first thing that I thought of.
Right? I'm still confused. Like, what are they doing?
Maybe
wrong?
You have to go back to college.
Maybe I do. Maybe I have to do a lot of things. I'll just add it to the list.
I'm sorry, that was
No, it's the truth.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
This week, it's the year ahead issue of the magazine. A favorite of the issue is the 50 companies to watch. It's also today's big take. So let's get into it with Rebecca Penty. She is Solutions and Strategy Senior Editor at Bloomberg Businessweek on the phone from the UK, along with Bloomberg Businessweek Editor Jill Weber from Brooklyn. Jill, I love this list. It gives you companies you're familiar with, some that you're not.
Yeah, this is an annual favorite at the magazine. It's a collaboration with Bloomberg Intelligence, and that just bears mentioning at the top because we couldn't do it without our colleagues there. The way that this whole project starts is they take this massive universe of companies that they cover, more than 2,000, and basically start running it through their spreadsheets, and it's just like this gigantic filtering effect to come up with these 50. And really excited about them because they're not hard calls. They're not, you know, buy and sell recommendations. That's not what we're going to get from Bloomberg Intelligence. I think it's more interesting and perhaps nuanced than that, because we think of them as just companies to watch. Some of them have positive sentiment, some of them have negative sentiment, but they're just ones that we think in the year ahead are going to be really, really, really interesting companies.
Yeah, so Rebecca, come on in here and talk a little bit about some of these companies here. I mean, the one that jumped out at me was Airbnb, because I feel like I've been watching Airbnb for years at this point after its huge IPO and the way the company was able to recover during the pandemic after laying off so many people. How did Airbnb make the cut?
Yeah, I think Airbnb will be quite familiar to a lot of us who wanted to travel during the pandemic but didn't feel safe at a hotel, for example. So bookings have been up, and interestingly, they've done really, really well with long stays, so people staying for kind of weeks on end. Now, the Bloomberg Intelligence analysts feel like Airbnb sets itself apart from rivals with its brand advantage. So it's very recognizable, and it doesn't even really need to spend that much in marketing. So that's where Bloomberg Intelligence says investors should be watching this company.
Okay, so another one that I love, and by the way, can we just all say when it's like whatever the weather was it 19? It feels like it's like single digits. Like I'm ready for travel, and Airbnb is definitely on that
warm.
List. So there's also, you know, New Year's resolutions. Lululemon, another one that's on the list. It's not even, they're bigger than just athleisure wear now, right? Right, Rebecca? Like their acquisition of Mirror has sort of changed what the company kind of looks like. Talk to us more about why Lululemon's on the list.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I think the idea of working out at home might have seemed like a niche thing before the pandemic. You know, not everyone has an in-home gym, but Lululemon's acquisition of Mirror actually was quite well-timed. This is the at-home gym where you can see your workout in the mirror. So like Peloton, they've done really well with that. Lululemon also has in-store events that they've been doing. So really, I guess the point is they're more than just yoga pants, and that's reflected in the positive outlook.
I got to say, I'm waiting for somebody to be like, Master, do you have anything else but yoga pants? I mean, I know it's more than yoga pants, but yoga pants and a top. That feels like work wear. Hey, First Solar is also on that list. It's been around for a while. Why is this one all of a sudden popping up on the list, Rebecca?
Yeah, I think one of the things that might be surprising to people who don't follow the solar industry super closely is that it's no longer super expensive. You know, it had this reputation of being, you know, a space that was just never going to get mainstream. But actually, solar is the most cost-competitive supply source for electric power now. And First Solar is the largest U.S. solar panel maker. They're investing at home and abroad, and they've just won a major order from the oil major BP and Lightstream BP, which is a renewables company that BP has a share in. So they're definitely one to watch.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the Asia-Pacific region and C. It's Southeast Asia's biggest gaming and e-commerce company. I think people who, I don't know, might have been following some growth names in the last couple of years would know C because in 2020 it was up nearly 400%, but it did not perform that well in 2021, only up 12%. Why is it on the list for 2022?
Yeah, so the thing with these mobile gaming companies like C is that they've got this huge number of players. C's got 700 million active players for its Free Fire game. And now it's branching into all sorts of new services, including online grocery delivery and fintech. And so the Bloomberg Intelligence analysts are saying, look, they've got 700 million active players of Free Fire that they can cross-market their new services to. So that's a huge bonus for them.
If we're going through regions, we've hit U.S., we've hit Asia. Let's bring it around to EMEA. What's a company with positive sentiment in Europe that we like, Rebecca?
Well, it might be kind of surprising that the Bloomberg Intelligence analysts have picked a tour operator when so many things are still shut down. They've picked TUI. So they are a European tour operator that BI thinks is poised to benefit from a return to travel. And, you know, we all remember Thomas Cook's failure during the pandemic. Investors are a little cautious on TUI because they just want to make sure that it's not going to follow in Thomas Cook's footsteps. But the tour operator's got a restructuring going on. It's upgrading its technology, and it's really changing the way it operates to focus on offering travelers flexibility and access to premium resorts. So that's definitely one to look at as people start to emerge from, you know, lockdowns and go see the sites.
All right, Rebecca, Robinhood. Man, we talked about it a lot last year. What do we need to be thinking about with this one? Because it made the list.
Yeah, so Robinhood is one that we've thought about a lot during the meme stock frenzies in mm-hmm. early 2021. But now they're, you know, under the thumb of regulators, including potentially the Securities and Exchange Commission, and there's a big lawsuit in Massachusetts that could help decide their fate and whether they have to impose stricter investor protection rules. So if they lose, that's going to be a big negative for Robinhood. And if they win, well, let's see.
Well, these are a great group to keep an eye on. And really, as you guys just took us around the world, really just something to look about throughout the global markets. Guys, we got to run. Thank you so much. Rebecca Penty, Solutions and Strategy Senior Editor at Bloomberg Business Week. Thanks so much for staying up. I know it's getting a little bit late there in the UK. And Joel Weber, Editor of Bloomberg Business Week on the Axis Line from Brooklyn. It's the year ahead issue.
Hey,
I love this issue.
I do too. There were a handful of companies on there I'd never heard of.
Me also.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, okay, good. That makes me feel better.
No, we're both like in the dark.
Okay.
A few things. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, Bitcoin boy, did you know it is down nearly, can I call you that?
Yeah, you can call me that.
It's down nearly 40% from its all-time high of about 68,000. I know it's up a little bit today, right?
It is up a little bit today. Yeah, the 68,000 number is one I've been thinking about a lot lately as we've seen this slide continue into
the beginning
of the year.
Where was I when it was 0.001 cent?
Yeah, you were not buying pizza with Bitcoin, okay?
No, but look how things have changed.
Yeah, they really have. 2022 is not off to a great start. And in fact, there's a technical indicator that we're watching closely right now, despite the fact that Bitcoin is up. It's called the death cross.
Dun, dun, dun.
And here to help us explain what exactly it is and why she's watching it so closely is Emily Grafeo, cross asset reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from New York City. Emily, okay, first of all, explain to people who do not have technical backgrounds what a death cross is.
You have to do it in an ominous way, too. No, I'm just kidding.
Of course. Well, it is a very ominous sounding technical signal. So the death cross is basically when Bitcoin's 50-day moving average dips below that of its 200-day moving average. So it basically means that the coin is falling really quickly, and you can see that in the price.
So a trend like that, when you are crossing trend lines, like when you are shorter term, crossing of that longer term, significant longer term trend line, what does it typically mean, or historically, does it mean that it's going to stay down? Or, you know, this is something, Bitcoin can be very volatile. So I'm just wondering, how do we read it? Technicians will read it one way, but fundamentally, how should we read it as well?
Yeah, so, I mean, everyone's really watching this. I think, one, because it has that really scary name, but also because in the past, we've seen some large price declines in Bitcoin after it's made this so-called death cross. So in November 2019, we had a death cross, and then the coin traded lower. But actually, there's been other times when it's flashed this technical signal, and even the technical analysts have pointed this out. It's flashed the signal and then actually moved higher. So it's kind of unclear whether this is a bullish or a bearish signal. Matty Greenspan of Quantum Economics, he had a report about the death cross, and he basically said for Bitcoin, you know, for all the previous death crosses that we've had, it's kind of been a good buying opportunity if you zoom out and look at Bitcoin.
Fake out.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's interesting you mentioned that, Emily, because Callie Cox, who is now at eToro, she was tweeting about this earlier. She sent a tweet that said, OMG, Bitcoin is approaching a death cross. And then she said, me, a data nerd, Bitcoin has gone through 8 death crosses since inception, but it hasn't died yet. But I still think there's this idea, Emily, that we do latch onto the technicals with Bitcoin because there really are no fundamentals for us to latch onto, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely harder with Bitcoin, especially when it's such a new asset class. I mean, there's another signal that I look at and that a lot of my colleagues on the cross asset team look at, and that's Bitcoin's correlation with the S&P 500. And so that basically measures if stocks are going up, is Bitcoin also going up? Are they trading together? And we've noticed that over the last year, that correlation has moved higher, which could mean that people are kind of viewing Bitcoin not really as a hedge or an alternative asset class, but really a speculative asset like they would view a stock.
Yeah, I mean, that is interesting. Like, I do think about some of the established technicals, right? They're all over the Bloomberg terminal. We use them for so many different asset classes. But you do wonder when it's something that, to some extent, even though cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin has been around now for a lot of years already, that do not the typical technicals, can we apply them in the same way? And do we need to kind of think about it differently?
Yeah, and then, I mean, even if you zoom out to the fundamental picture, a lot of strategists that I've spoken to who are kind of bullish about Bitcoin in the long term have even admitted lately that the downtrend that we've seen in Bitcoin kind of has to do with the fact that it has been trading like a speculative asset, and we had this news from the Federal Reserve at the end of 2021 that they were going to be more hawkish. So now you're seeing all of these speculative assets like Bitcoin, like tech stocks, start to cool off.
So I wonder about what your sources are saying, what analysts you speak to, or what they're talking about with other technicals with Bitcoin, because another technical that we oftentimes hear about is dollar is actually like, you know, levels, right? 40,000, 39,000 are levels that have been bandied about in recent days. And it indeed does seem like we have seen some sort of bounce off of lows in recent days. What are you hearing from in terms of a lower level?
Yeah, you're right, Tim. Actually, the 40,000, that's a technical support level that Bloomberg Intelligence has. So it does seem like we dipped below 40,000. I think it was 2 days ago now. That was for the first time since September. But we bounced pretty nicely, and now we're up even higher at 42,000. In terms of levels, though, there was an interesting JP Morgan survey, and they surveyed their clients and asked, where do you expect Bitcoin to be by the end of 2022? And 41% said 60,000, and we already hit a record high of 69,000 in November. So if we ended this year at 60,000, that wouldn't be a very exciting year for Bitcoin gains.
Kind of a dun dun dun.
I feel like the skull emoji is the death cross. Like whenever I hear death cross, I just feel like somebody sent me a text with the skull emoji in it.
So true. You look up in the sky, black clouds, and you'll see it as well. Thank you. Emily Grafeo, she is cross asset reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone in New York City. Dun dun dun.
Skull emoji.
Exactly. This is Bloomberg.
I'm driving in my car.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we've got 10 and a half minutes left in the trading day. And folks, we're just coming off our best levels of the session, as we've been talking about, Doug Krisner, up really on the NASDAQ, up about 1.2%. So the outperformance there. Let's get to it. Doug Cioka is back, CEO and partner at Kavar Capital Partners, over $1 billion in assets. And he's on the phone from Leawood, Kansas. Doug Cioka, happy, happy new year. How are you?
I am fantastic. Happy New Year to you and Tim as well.
It's really great to have you here. So help me make sense of these first, 5, 6, 7 days of 2022.
Yeah, it's been interesting, right? Fast and furious right out of the gate. And, you know, it's an incredible amount of price dislocation very early. And, you know, we've come to taking, and maybe this may be more of a Midwestern perspective, of this being the anti-Ted Lasso effect.
I like this.
I don't know if you guys are Ted Lasso fans.
Oh, yeah. Yes. We've both seen both seasons.
Yes.
Oh, great. So there's a scene in the first season, and Ted is playing darts, and he suggests to his opponent that he should be curious and not judgmental, right? And that is exactly the opposite of what the market tends to do, right? It's always been a collection of investors who are kind of fire-ready aim. And I think that's the worst approach for this market, right? If you're a curious investor, you might ask, what was the best performing industry sector the last tightening cycle?
Right.
If you're a curious investor, you might say, what were the best performing asset classes during the last liquidity extraction? But a judgmental investor is making this impatient determination that a great unwind must be forthcoming because we are transitioning away from easy money environment, and we just don't think the Fed is going to be so disruptive to corporate prosperity as to warrant some bleak prognostication, particularly when we anticipate earnings to indicate otherwise.
Well, hence, I'm going back to a great comment by Steve Sosnick. Am I saying it right? I think so. I hope so. Steve, let me know if I'm not. But Steve, a comment by him is in one of our Bloomberg write-throughs, and he calls Jay Powell Goldilocks in a suit. And it does feel like, Doug, like I get it. Like it does feel like, even though watching the financial markets is not part of the Fed's mandate, that Jay Powell's not going to want to do anything that is too disruptive in terms of the financial markets, because that impacts a lot of things, certainly in our world. So he's watching a lot of stuff, if you will, in terms of the moves that they're going to make.
Oh, I don't think there's any question. I think that's a very good way to characterize it. And if you look at just today's trading action, right, with Powell in center stage, and everyone is tuned into what he's saying for two reasons, I think, right? One, was he even more hawkish than he had been in the release of the last meeting's minutes, which came out last Wednesday, which kind of triggered this 30 basis point backup of the 10-year. Number two, did he say anything that was going to imperil his prospects of being reconfirmed? And I think the answer to both of those is no, right? So I think we're seeing a little reversal today, or maybe a relief rally from what has led so far this year. But it is interesting, right? Because can you guys give me an example of when any Fed has exhibited proactivity or successfully issued a preemptive strike? Because I can't, right? And by virtue of the fact that they call themselves data-driven, it almost takes it off the table. Yet for some reason, investors expect them to be proactive, but I think the very best we can hope for is a soft landing, and Goldilocks would engineer something that, I guess, the best prospects of engineering something along those lines.
Okay. So take us to your themes of 2022 and help us understand how you can put these theories into practice when it comes to asset allocation and what you're bullish on for the year.
Yeah, thank you. So Tim, we have three themes, right? We really feel like there's going to be an international monetary policy non-conformity, right? Their recovery speeds are alternating around the globe, right? So there are going to be different policy postures predicated on where we are in the cycle of economic recovery coming out of the global pandemic. So there are going to be some direct organic investments into certain countries and also some what we're calling inorganic or currency-motivated moves to be made in others. So that's our first theme, is international monetary policy non-conformity. Second theme is finally some mean reversion in catching up in international stocks and value stocks. Like, could this be the year where they have their quote-unquote day in the sun, right? And it's been over a decade since international investments have outperformed domestic counterparts, and almost as long for value stocks. But we do feel like the expected returns may finally be at levels that are going to be conducive to elevated portfolio weights in this area. Because if you think about the Fed in a tightening posture, there's likely to be little to no multiple expansion. So in our individual stock portfolios, we think you need to favor better than average earnings growers, and that would thereby impute an absence of high debt levels, those companies that paid dividends, and those also that have a moat of competitive protection, very wide and deep, to pass along higher input prices to their customers.
Right.
That kind of is a characterization of a value stock.
Hey, Doug, let me ask you, though, about some of those big technology names. And, like, you just hear so many people kind of, okay, they've had their day in the sun. Having said that, a lot of these names have great visibility, and they have deep pockets, if you look at their balance sheet, and are able to weather, you know, a lot. What are your thoughts on some of the FANG names that are out there?
Yeah, I think so. I would kind of differentiate the FANG names from some of those companies, Carol, that were the poster children for kind of the speculative excess going into the latter part of an easy money cycle, right? And we're seeing a lot of re-rating in some of those names right now and in some of those categories. So be they meme stocks, crypto stocks, SPAC stocks, right? These are companies that didn't have that type of visibility.
Right.
And I do think if this is a thing, there is also some window undressing that's taking place, where portfolio managers that were chasing benchmarks that bought names into the portfolio that they may not be intent on keeping because they'd performed so well over the last 3 to 5 years.
Right.
So we're probably seeing a little bit of rotation cyclically out of some of the tech in general into some value areas, but ultimately I think there'll be a re-engagement of the FANG stocks because of their high and strong visible corporate growth.
All right, Doug, really just quickly, I want to make sure I've got it right. Anti-Ted Lasso effect. So in other words, we should be curious and not judgmental. Just 10 seconds, right? We should be curious
and not judgmental. Yeah, I mean, if you think about the last tightening cycle, the Fed raised rates 9 times, undertook a balance sheet reduction, and the 10-year went from 2.4 to 3.2. Leading sector in the S&P, tech. But
I know.
All sectors were higher.
Yeah, right?
We talked. Large growth was best, but there was a pretty tight correlated ascendancy back then, and who knows if that's going to happen this time, but I think we need to be curious to your point and not judgmental.
I love it. You sometimes said that I'm a calming voice when it comes to things that are crazy, and you've been a calming voice in an environment that has really raised a lot of questions, so love you for that. Be well. Doug Sciocca, CEO and partner at Kavar Capital Partners, joining us on the phone from Leawood, Kansas.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.